Curtis Hill's lawyers threaten a defamation suit. President Trump versus Dan Coats. That, plus Senate fundraising numbers and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 20th, 2018.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, lawyers for Attorney General Curtis Hill sought to discredit parts of a leaked report that contains sexual misconduct allegations against Hill, and they threatened to bring a defamation suit against an unknown person who perhaps wrote part of the report. There are a few discrepancies between the report, which contains accusations against Curtis Hill, and first-person accounts from the alleged victims. Hill's attorney, Kevin Betts, claims those differences show someone intentionally put what he calls false and malicious information in the report, and he wants legislative leaders to identify that person. Betts also criticized those leaders and Governor Eric Holcomb, who called on Hill to resign.
The politicians have called for his resignation and impeachment, and I'm here to say that is pure hysteria.
Betts also wants to bring a defamation claim against the unknown person who leaked the report to the press. What should we make of Curtis Hill's latest move? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette State House reporter Nikki Kelly. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, what should Hoosiers make of this latest development?
Well, the political strategy here is to muddy this up, misdirect it, throw out a lot of accusations to people who aren't named and may not exist. For most Hoosiers, I think they've got to decide what's more plausible. Is there a vast conspiracy that goes to the highest levels from both parties, the highest elected officials in the state from both parties, to conspire to throw a guy out of office or force him to resign for an office no one really cares about? Or did Curtis Hill drink too much and act inappropriately? I mean, that's really the choice here, right? I mean, if you're just a bystander looking at this situation, you go, I don't know about all of this. I think the guy just drank too much and went and acted inappropriately at a bar. And now whether they think he should resign for that, the conspiracy here is too outrageous, I think, for your average Hoosier who's just looking at the situation and never in their life have thought about the office of the Attorney General.
Yeah. How many people knew Curtis Hill's name, I suppose, before this?
He was a top vote-getter.
That's because no one cares who the Attorney General is. That's the analysis. It's not because he's so popular.
That's exactly right.
If this press conference seems to be more about the PR battle than any potential actual legal battle that might be forthcoming, was it an effective move?
I don't think so. I mean, you look at that and you say, what is going on? He's taken a page out of Donald Trump's book, okay? The first thing you do is deny, 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 deny. The next thing you do is you try to intimidate the accusers. And that's what this is about, the threatened lawsuit. There is no defamation here. And by the way, if it's true, by definition, it can't be defamation. So you've got those problems there. Frankly, you've got six pretty credible witnesses on this, and I don't know how many other people saw his performance at that bar, but a number did, I know. And you've got that weighed against a non-denial denial. It's like, well, that can't be right because you forgot to dot that I. I mean, that's about basically what he's saying. I may have only touched her once, not twice. Come on. I mean, he ought to save himself the embarrassment of this, and he ought to go into the national administration where he'd be welcomed.
Nikki, you were at the press conference. Do you think Curtis Hill got anything out of it?
I think probably the goal was to point out a few inconsistencies between the original report, summaries of the interviews with the women, and their first-person accounts. So in that case, sure, several of us wrote stories that pointed out small inconsistencies. But in the end, as Ann just said, I mean, the question is, I mean, does it matter if he only touched the lawmaker's butt once over the clothing? You know, is that way different than, you know, oh, we touched it twice under? I mean, the fact is that they still aren't talking about whether he touched them at all. All they keep saying is he hasn't touched anyone inappropriately. They won't answer the question about whether he touched anyone at all.
What do you make of this? Kevin Betts, the attorney, one of the attorneys who was at this press conference, who was representing Curtis Hill, has ties to Curtis Hill. He served on his transition team, I believe. But he said he's not getting paid, doesn't plan to get paid, then later said he might be paid, but if he does, it won't be taxpayer dollars.
Did you
follow all of that?
First of all, did you follow all of that?
There's a GoFundMe page.
It's a surprise. I've known Kevin Betts and admired his work for 30-plus years. I always knew him in the context of representing First Amendment cases. He was, you know, a journalist, actually, I think at some point in his career, early on as well, and always has been a real champion of open government and the First Amendment. So to see threats coming from that source about defamation suits in what would appear to be an attempt to...
Intimidate,
or at least to stifle discussion about public officials is surprising. But I think the assessment that, I mean, if anybody just wanted, you know, the quick down and dirty, this is what it is. I think it's exactly right. It's an attempt to sort of cloud things so that you're spending a lot of time maybe looking at this, maybe looking at that. But in the end, I just don't see how this changes the landscape really at all.
And the other thing is you have a summary that somebody edited based on conversations. You're always going to have inconsistencies with that. And the first-person narrative on what happened is what counts, not someone else's regurgitation of what they think they heard in the interview. The bottom line on this is they're not filing the lawsuit. That's another page before they filed it, they better get some other outside counsel's advice because
I would just add that anytime somebody does file a lawsuit, that does open the door to deposition and subpoena. Yeah. And a lot of times people might say, gee, do I really want to go down that path because it may not have the outcome I desire.
Yeah. Uh-huh. All right. Amen. Members of Indiana's congressional delegation rushed to the defense of former Hoosier Senator and now Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats this week when President Trump contradicted Coats' assessment of threats from Russia. At a press conference at a Helsinki summit with Russian leader Vladimir Putin, President Trump said he saw no reason why it would be Russia who meddled in the 2016 U.S. election. 24 hours later, the White House walked back those comments, saying he meant wouldn't, though Trump then contradicted Coates and the nation's intelligence community again when he said there was no ongoing threat from Russia. In between that, Indiana lawmakers voiced messages of support for Coates and his assessment, each declaring that Russia is not a friend of the United States. But none of the Hoosier Republicans who spoke out in any way rebuked the president for his remarks. Only one, Congressman Jim Banks, even mentioned Trump.
Ann Delaney, does this support for Dan Coats mean as much if they don't mention at all Donald Trump?
It doesn't mean all that much. And today you had the White House saying that he'd gone rogue. That Dan Coats had gone rogue.
I don't think that's been a term ever described
for
Dan Coats.
So it's kind of a precursor. He may be the next Comey. And from his point of view, he may want that. He may want to be fired. He'll make a hell of a lot more money writing a book and going on the speaking circuit than he ever will be there. And he's obviously out of the loop. I mean, he didn't even know. Nobody knows what kind of a deal Donald Trump cut with the Russians. I mean, the idea that we were talking about giving a former ambassador over to the KGB is incredible. It's absolutely incredible, and he calls it a good idea. You know, it may be in Dan Coats' best interest to get fired. This guy is totally off the rails. He's in love with our enemy. You know, the one question I'd like to ask Dan Coats is, what are you doing to make sure the Russians don't intrude themselves on the Indiana senatorial race this year and on the other key races which control the Senate? Because they're not going to come in on the side of Joe Donnelly. They're going to come in on the Trump echo, Mike Braun.
That maybe answers my question to you as much as anything else, which is Dan Coats has served his country for a long time in various roles, but, I mean, you have White House officials calling him rogue and all this. Why is Dan Coats still there?
Well, in part, I think both Dan Coats and other members of the intelligence community are in kind of an unprecedented situation where they've really got to balance their obligation to the president and serving him and the oath they took to protect the Constitution and protect the country. And I think Dan Coats in particular through his whole career, has felt a strong sense of obligation as a citizen and someone to kind of take the lead there. So I think he said in the last 24 hours that he would stay as long as he was able to kind of speak the truth and talk openly and honestly about the real threats before us. In this case, the evidence the intelligence community has pulled together that Russia did in fact interfere in the election.
And are still
what's
trying.
Separate from that, which I think is getting blended here by the president, and I don't quite understand it. These are two separate things. The question, did Russia interfere? Yes, according to the intelligence community. Did the Trump campaign collude with Russia? No, and there's been no evidence of that. I think it seems almost like the president's...
That's not true. There's been no evidence.
The president's passion for that issue seems to kind of leak over into this issue, and I think they're separate issues.
I think it's all about whether he was legitimately elected. That's what he's worried about, is that
because
they colluded...
I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, the intelligence community has said that they did not change the election results did not change.
And how do you know that? When it's 55,000 votes over four states. 55,000 votes over four states, and when you had all that targeted information through Facebook and Wikipedia...
Well, I'm just saying, if we're to believe the intelligence community says that Russia interfered, then we should also believe them when they say, but they didn't change election results.
I think that part of it's an opinion.
You're right. It is an opinion. Democrats opine that if Russia interfered, then Hillary Clinton really should have been president.
Well, she got more votes.
With no evidence.
She got 3 million
votes. That's not our system of government, Ann.
Let me ask this about Dan Coats. What do you think happens first? Dan Coats leaves or Dan Coats gets fired?
Well, sometimes you can't tell in this White House which it is. The story kind of goes back and forth. We've seen that several times. People are fired. People are resigned. We saw that with Mike Flynn, first and foremost. You know, it's a tough call for a lot of people who've served the country, as Dan Coats has. There's probably, yes, there's a commitment to the president, the commander-in-chief, but also I think for many of these individuals, there's a commitment to country. And so the question is, if you think that the ship of state is sailing precariously close to the rocky shoals,
treason?
Are you serving your country by, you know, resigning in some sort of show of frustration, or do you get an oar and you're like trying to pedal as fast as you can? I mean, it's a tough call.
That comes down to, I think, generally where some people, you know, you try to fix it from the inside, and I think that's what Dan Coats is doing, is he's trying to have some sort of impact internally, but clearly that's not happening. I mean, he and Trump are so divergent on Russia and he's completely out of the loop. That ABC News
Trump
interview
came back
where
and corrected himself, though.
Even on the ABC News thing, I mean, he had to be told by a reporter on stage that they had invited Putin to the White House.
And has no idea what kind of a deal they cut, which is what's even more frightening.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: do you believe President Trump misspoke when he said Russia didn't interfere in the 2016 election? A yes or B, no. Last week's question, so should Senator Joe Donnelly vote for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee? 23% say yes, 77% say no. If you would like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun outraised Democrat incumbent Joe Donnelly in the year's second fundraising quarter, while Donnelly has a sizable advantage in cash on hand. Braun announced he'd brought in $2.5 million this past quarter, more than half of it since the May 8th primary. And none of it came from Braun loaning himself any money, which is largely how he'd funded his primary campaign. But while Braun ended his quarter with about $1 million in his campaign war chest, Joe Donnelly boasts more than $6 million cash on hand. That's after a roughly $2 million haul in the second quarter. Donnelly's campaign noted 93% of donations in the period were for $50 or less. Thank you, Kelly. It seems most people seem to agree that outside spending will almost certainly eclipse what the campaigns themselves spend on this race, and that's been the case for a lot of high-profile races here in Indiana. So how much do these fundraising numbers from the candidates themselves really matter in the grand scheme?
I mean, mean, I don't think they matter as much in the traditional sense as they would in the governor's race, where literally most of the money being spent is directly from the candidates themselves. But I do think it's part of a sort of, you know, you're trying to show your supporters the strength of your campaign overall. And in that sense, I think that's how they are using those numbers.
How then important was the fact that Mike Braun outraised Joe Donnelly this quarter and did so without a single personal loan to the campaign, which he relied on?
I think that's what was significant, in that it was a departure from what we saw in the primary, where he's a wealthy businessman. He was able to self-fund. And anyone observing the race might have concluded that he would adhere to the same practice. So the fact that he was able to ring the cash register to the extent he did, certainly good news for him and a positive sign for him. But it's, you know, the notion here, this is probably, to the extent that there are any, I hate to use the word negative and positive, that there are any autobiographical or position-based, here's what I want to do type advertising, this is the pot of money it would come out of. Because you look at the independent expenditures, there's not a whole lot of you know, rallying around someone as much as there
attacking
and tearing down.
Sure.
So to the extent that we're actually going to hear somebody in terms of paid media put forth a position, a platform, and specifics about what I want to do to address this problem or to promote Indiana in this manner, it's almost certainly going to come through this channel.
Donnelly, 93% of the donations in this quarter for $50 or less. That traditionally you think, oh, that's grassroots support. How important is that for Joe Donnelly?
It's always a good sign if you can have a large number of low dollar donors. A lot of these campaigns, though, strategically it's not organic. I mean, they're out, like, shaking this out, and they're even telling people they can give more to give less, or give, you know, because most of the money's coming from out of state, so they can show strength in those numbers. I mean, the bottom line on cash on hand, I mean, Joe Donnelly's had a six-year head start on fundraising. It's not surprising at all. I mean, we had a competitive primary on the Republican side, where more money was raised, and more money than Joe Donnelly had raised up to that point. And Mike Braun's just in a different situation now, right? Everybody's going to go invest in one guy now instead of waiting to see how three guys fight it out. So it was a good early money show support.
Yeah, how much is this? Are these numbers better news for Mike Braun or Joe Donnelly?
It doesn't matter. There's going to be so much money spent in this campaign.
Money will not be the problem.
Money is not the issue. But what's interesting about this is the IRS has now said that these other entities no longer have to divulge who makes the contributions. So when you get hit by these out-of-state ads, you're not even going to know whose money is in there.
Yeah, that's true on both sides.
Well, that's right. And it's a bad offshoot of that Supreme Court decision.
The state of Indiana has paid at least $21 million to clean up dozens of sites left contaminated after the collapse of Keel Brothers Oil Company, which was run by now congressional candidate Greg Pence. A report from the Associated Press details some of the pollution costs generated by the now defunct oil company. But the company itself has paid only a small part of cleanup costs, in part because the state of Indiana, under Mitch Daniels, decided to abandon its pursuit of a more than $8 million claim against the company after it went bankrupt. Both Vice President Mike Pence, who once worked for the company, and his brother Greg, its former president, dismissed questions by the AP about its report as a rehash of years-old issues. The state still pays for cleanup of the company's sites. Keel Brothers' sites still ranked among the top 10 recipients of state money for such cleanups in Indiana in 2013. John Schwanes, let's start with this. Putting aside the connection, the obvious connections to the Pence family, is the state system itself for contamination cleanup so flawed when taxpayers are responsible for footing so much of the bill?
It would seem that way. I mean, we talked earlier about Hoosier values or Hoosier common sense and how the average Hoosier views things. And I think the average Hoosier would say, you make a mess, you clean it up, whether it's a kid's bedroom or, you know, something on a scale like this. And even when you had, you know, in court documents, the suggestion that this company had put forth certain amounts of money, $8 million, $8.8 million in one case, $5 million of that, if you read, you know, next line down, basically,
yeah,
you see that it comes from the state. So it seems that the state I know we want to create a good business atmosphere here, but it seems awfully forgiving to let something that significant and that enduring. We're talking about a company that declared bankruptcy in 2004, and we still don't even know. IDEM's unable at this point to give us a list that's complete and comprehensive. And it's, let's just say, and it's a good thing it wasn't student loan debt, because I don't think that could be discharged.
No,
maybe our bankruptcy
not.
Trustee can address that. But
The part of the fund that the state uses, not just for Keel Brothers, but for all of these sorts of cleanups, I'm not going to pretend like Keel is the only one that is cleaning up sites in this state. But part of the primary fund that the state uses to pay for a lot of this stuff, the money that's paid into it by the gas stations is taxes paid by Hoosiers at the pump. So, I mean, at what point do the taxpayers get any relief here?
Well, I mean, that's up to lawmakers if they want to redo that law. I've not heard any interest in doing so. Obviously, each individual business pays like tank fees and things like that in there. And as long as they stay compliant, then the state will clean it up later on. Maybe we need to look at higher tank fees that cover more of the cost.
You know, what's ironic about this is that Greg Pence and Mike Braun both say that they're successful businessmen, and that's why they should go to Congress to take these the subset of skills they've developed with them. Okay, Greg Pence not only left us this to clean up, but he welched on the debt that he took from the bank that he was on the board of. He was personally guaranteeing that. He kept the money in his pocket and paid the bank pennies on the dollar. And while he was there with this cleanup that he left the citizens around the state of Indiana to pay for, he had his brother sign a bill which raised the cap on each individual contaminated site, again, at taxpayer expense. He wants to take that to Congress, the same as Mike Braun, who wants to treat his employees badly and get fined by state after state after state for practices like that. Those are not the kinds of skills we need in Congress. They may fit right in the Republican caucus in Washington, but it's not what we need in Congress.
Does any of this really blow back on Greg Pence?
I'd like to spend a few more minutes talking about Curtis Hill. I have some thoughts that I didn't get a chance to cover earlier. I don't ultimately, no. I mean, look, this is a business that unfortunately went bankrupt. And the state has a decision to make. Taxpayers either are going to pay to clean these sites up or they're not. And it doesn't just apply to gas stations. I think it applies to other sites of contamination. So we dealt with Northwest Indiana during when some of those steel mills went out of business in South Chicago. And, you know, so the state's got a decision to make. Now, should we reform the system or reinsure the program, or if there's some other financial mechanism to ensure that taxpayers aren't on the hook to this degree? The legislature will probably address that next session.
Well, the Indiana Election Commission denied this week a challenge to Secretary of State Connie Lawson's eligibility in the upcoming election. Connie Lawson was appointed Secretary of State in March of 2012. She was then elected to the position in 2014 and is running for another 4-year term this year. A challenge to her candidacy says the Indiana Constitution only allows someone to serve in the office for 8 years in a 12-year span, meaning Lawson could only serve until 2020, halfway through her next term, if she wins. But Attorney William Barrett, representing Lawson, says another provision of the Constitution says time served for a, quote, pro tempore appointment, a temporary one, doesn't count toward that limit. The Indiana Election Commission unanimously agreed and sided with Lawson. Mike O'Brien, is Connie Lawson perhaps stretching constitutional limits a little bit here?
Not according to the bipartisan Indiana Election Commission that unanimously decided no, she's not, and that she's eligible to be on the ballot. So, and the gentleman who brought the complaint didn't even show up at the hearing. So,
that's true. Andrew Horning was out of state on business. He said
that important. That important.
Let me ask this though. I mean, the Constitution clearly says what it says, but is this what it envisioned?
Look, you know, how many in recent years Republicans in statewide office didn't serve their term? Seven? Seven of them left before they served the 4-year term? And, you know, she's going to lose. She's going to leave, too, because we're going to beat her in November. So there you go. Don't worry about it.
I wasn't expecting
she
that
doesn't
part.
Have to, she doesn't have to have the constitutional question raised.
Do you think
voters
there was,
will do it.
Yeah. This one, is this now in the rearview mirror completely? Or do you think this will hang over her at all?
Oh, it won't hang over at all. Though it is a fascinating discussion. I mean, I think most common sense users would say, if you're serving two years in an appointment, is that temporary? Probably not, you know. We talk a lot about the plain meaning of statutes and constitutions, But, you know, I'm not surprised. The Election Commission is not one to kind of upset the apple cart. They would definitely leave that to a judge.
Yeah, was this...
Well, it shows that strict constructionists, when it comes to constitutional matters, are only strict constructionists until
they're
not.
They like the outcome.
And that's when sometimes you got to kind of morph with the times.
With the times, that's what it means. That finally, electric scooter companies Bird and Lime will be able to do business in Indianapolis after regulations were approved by the City County Council this week. Companies must purchase a license that costs $15,000 a year, pay $1 per day per device, and agree to a number of stipulations. So, Ann Delaney, any celebratory scooter rides in your future?
You know, I can't think of anything more frightening than going down a sidewalk in Indianapolis, dodging pedestrians at 15 miles an hour on a scooter,
and then going in the street
and perhaps hitting a sinkhole and winding up in China. I don't think that's in the cards for me, no.
Was this whole debate, this weeks-long debate over these scooter companies, legitimate or just legitimately ridiculous?
They had some legitimate questions. I mean, because, one, no one knew what happened overnight, right?
That's true.
They just dropped all these, and then you're driving downtown, and nobody knows how to do it yet, and they're zipping out of alleys and riding the streets, and nobody knew what to do.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.